If we were going to increase the number of women in the legislature at the rate we're currently going, it'll take us 300 years.
From Wyoming Public Media, this is The Modern West. I'm Micah Schweitzer. On this month's episode, we're going to hear from a series called Women Run the West. The series explores the role of women in Western politics. It's a collaboration between Utah Public Radio's Jennifer Pemberton and Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard. We'll start with some history. Nearly 150 years ago, Wyoming was the first place in the country to grant women the right to vote. Congress didn't pass the 19th Amendment guaranteeing all American women the right to vote until 1919, and it was ratified by states in 1920. So Wyoming was ahead of its time, giving women the vote in 1869. But there are conflicting accounts as to why the state was a trailblazer. Caroline Ballard brings us that story.
Back in June, Wyoming Governor Matt Mead signed an executive order to organize a celebration of the 150th anniversary of women getting the right to vote in Wyoming.
Wyoming Women's Suffrage Celebration. Whereas Wyoming has a distinctive history with respect to women's suffrage, to wit, at the end of their session in 1869, the Wyoming Territorial Legislature granted female suffrage, the first government in the world to do so under an unconditional and general franchise.
Wyoming was ahead of its time, giving women the vote in 1869. But there are conflicting accounts as to why Wyoming was a trailblazer.
Well, when you look at the context of the time, there were other territories besides Wyoming territory that were looking to try this.
That's historian Rick Ewig. Those other territories, Washington and Nebraska, failed. He says Wyoming succeeded because certainly there were people who believed in women's rights. But more importantly, many people thought this would improve Wyoming's chances of becoming a state.
Let's advertise Wyoming and let people know around the country that women could now vote in Wyoming, the first place that they would have full suffrage. And so that would be a very important draw, some people thought.
So did it work?
Not really.
It would be more than 20 years before Wyoming got the numbers to become a state. Ewig says there was also a little-known political reason for voting on suffrage. He says it was a way for an all-Democratic legislature to embarrass its Republican governor.
They would pass the bill, stand up for women's rights, and then he would probably veto it. And that would make the Democrats look even better.
The governor didn't veto it, and women were granted the right to vote. The state went on to have more firsts for gender equality. The first woman to cast a vote, the first woman justice of the peace, and the first woman governor. Eventually, the first stopped. But Ewig says the idea lived on.
We can go back to 1869 and feel good about being the first territory, and then in 1890, the first state. But overall, when you look at today, the firsts may make us feel better, but they certainly haven't proven to be reasons for us to continue to be the first in other areas of equal rights.
For example, the gender wage gap in Wyoming is the second largest in the country, and it will be decades before that gap is closed. The equality state also has the nation's lowest representation of women in state politics. As for that last piece, recently some groups are making an effort to improve women's representation in politics in the state. Leap into Leadership is a conference organized by the Wyoming Women's Legislative Caucus that promotes women in the legislature and leadership development. At that event in February, Bernadine Kraft, the only woman senator in the state, said it's a shame the equality state doesn't have more female representation.
We all bring different things to the table. We all have different talents, skills, abilities, and when there's only one woman, there are a lot of voices that are being silenced.
And she said more needs to be done.
Change does come slowly. I had an interesting little statistic here that said that if we were going to increase the number of women in the legislature at the rate we're currently going, it'll take us 300 years.
Both Kraft and State Representative Ruth Ann Petroff said the way to change is partly through better recruitment.
I don't know who takes it on, but a group of mentors in each community that is actively working to recruit people to be interested in these offices.
Petroff and Kraft are both stepping down from office this year, but it seems better recruitment may already be paying off. More women are running to take their place. In 2014's primaries, 27 women ran for the legislature. This year, there were 40. But will voters support them?
There aren't many women serving in Utah's legislature, but a new law this election year gives hopeful political candidates a new way to get on their party's primary ballot. Jennifer Pemberton looked into whether or not the new alternative to Utah's caucus convention system might help get more women elected.
There are currently 10 women serving in the Utah House of Representatives and 6 in the state Senate. Together, they make up 15% of the 104 elected state legislators. This puts Utah in the bottom 10 states for percentage of women represented in state legislature. There are a lot of reasons for the disparity between men and women serving as elected state officials, but according to Katie Ziegler with the National Convention of State Legislatures, none of them has to do with electability.
There's not bias at the ballot box, and you just have to take a step back and realize that when you look at the numbers, women aren't running for state legislative offices in the numbers that would increase the numbers of women elected. To put it more simply, women aren't running, and so they're not getting elected. When women run, women win.
Except when they don't, which we'll get to in a moment. Maybe it's not obvious why we need more women in office, but we live in a representative democracy, and that means, in theory, that our legislative bodies should look like our population. In Utah, our population is 49.7% female, but our legislature is only 15% female, which isn't very representative. Ziegler says that women running for state legislatures can lead to more women in office all the way up the chain.
Looking nationally and at higher office, such as Congress, currently about 50% almost of members of Congress previously served in state legislatures. And so you think about political candidates as existing in a pipeline, and there's this pool of people that maybe someday will make a run for Congress, whether it's the House or the U.S. Senate, and there aren't a lot of women in that pool.
One way to add women to that pool is by actively recruiting women to run.
Women don't tend to be self-starters as far as political candidacy goes. It takes recruiting a woman. It takes somebody asking her, you should do it, you should throw your hat in the ring. Women that I work with have told me over and over, someone asked me 4 times before I said yes.
In Utah, that push for more women to run in the first place comes from a group called Real Women Run. The nonpartisan organization holds trainings for potential female candidates on how to manage a campaign, how to fundraise, how to work with the media, even hands-on stuff like how to actually file for candidacy. Pleasant Grove resident Zanny Haney showed up to one of these trainings back in January. By the end of the all-day workshop, she decided she was going to run as a Republican for a seat in the Utah House of Representatives.
We have one demographic, basically, that's making all of our state laws. We need more women on the Capitol Hill. We only have 13% currently in the House of Representatives, and I think we need to encourage more women to run.
The incumbent in Haney's district is Republican Representative Brian Green. And in January, no one was signed up to run against him.
I knew that no one else was going to step up to the game, and I had done my research and was starting to be backed by a lot of local people. And people just kind of rallied behind me, and they wanted another option. So for me, that was the decision, and someone needed to step up.
I caught up with Haney at the Utah County GOP convention in April, where the delegates had just voted in her race.
The voting went okay. I landed at 33% approval.
She needed 40% to move on to a primary. And last election, she wouldn't have had enough to stay in the race. But a new state law passed in 2014 gives candidates 2 routes to getting elected. The old caucus and convention route and a new signature gathering route that can get candidates directly onto their party's primary ballot. You can even do both. So if you're a first-time candidate like Haney running against an incumbent like Representative Green, you can try your best to get delegates to vote for you at the convention, and you can gather voter signatures as a backup.
So I started gathering signatures in about February, and I knocked about 800 doors, and that was an interesting experience in the middle of February, but it was a good experience.
How many signatures did you need?
I needed 1,000, and I had to get about 1,800 because only 40% were verifiable.
So Haney forced a primary, so to speak, and prepared to face her opponent. And then her own party started actively campaigning against her. The Utah GOP was opposed to the new law allowing signature gathering from the beginning, and even going so far as to sue the state to overturn it. The Utah County GOP financially supported and endorsed Representative Green as the traditional nominee from the convention and refused to recognize candidates like Haney, who gathered signatures to get on the ballot. In June, she lost the primary by fewer than 200 votes. There's no Democratic candidate for the district, so Representative Brian Green will hold the seat for another term. It's too early to tell how much of an impact the signature gathering option will have on Utah elections, especially when it comes to the representation of women. Utah is only one of seven states that uses the caucus convention primary system, and with this new alternative path to getting elected and all the resistance toward it from the Utah Republican Party, the 2016 election is a real experiment in what representative democracy looks like.
On the other hand, it's pretty easy to get on a primary ballot in Wyoming. It only takes a few things: meeting age and residency requirements, signing your name, and $200. But there's a whole new set of challenges when it comes to actually running a campaign. Caroline Ballard has the story of one woman who took on the odds of campaigning herself.
Julie McAllister is not shy.
Hi, how are you? I'm Julie. Nice to meet you. Julie.
Rich Keeley.
Nice to meet you.
It's a good thing she isn't shy, too, because Julie McAllister is running for office, the Wyoming State House seat in House District 47. I'm out with her on a hot and sunny July day in Saratoga, where she was campaigning at an art show. She approached potential voters, chatting about everything from art.
That is absolutely one of the most beautiful pieces of bronze I've ever seen in my life.
To why she's qualified to serve.
And I really hope to have the opportunity to show my voters that it's something that I will give my entire heart and mind to.
After schmoozing with the attendees and buying a few art prints, McAllister retreated to her truck in the parking lot, which she had been using as a makeshift campaign headquarters, driving all over southern Wyoming to knock on doors and get her name out there. She said she had always been interested in politics and public service,
but honestly had never imagined myself as a candidate or as a rep until around 2012, 2013, after a lot of soul searching and thought it was time to put my money where my mouth was and put myself in the situation to affect change positively, to do the hard work, commit to it 103,000%.
The race is tough for McAllister. She's young for politics at 36, and like many women, she has a lot to juggle. She's a full-time caregiver for her husband, who was paralyzed in a work accident. And she's facing off against incumbent Representative Jerry Paxton. He already beat her once in 2014. But all that doesn't deter her.
The mistakes I made in 2014, I've learned from now in 2016, and I'm building on those, so I'm actually more confident. The only thing I'm afraid of is the fact I care. This is important, high value, high risk for me. Not because I'm facing an incumbent, not because I'm a woman. Those reasons don't scare me. What scares me is because I care so much.
Many of the potential challenges McAllister faces are typical for female candidates. Family obligations, limited manpower and finances, and she's running against a male incumbent. These reasons have repeatedly been cited in studies by American University and the Brookings Institution as reasons more women don't run for office in the first place. But growing a support system can be done. It just takes time.
It is a hurdle. It's not a barrier. Figure out how to get over it.
That's Gail Geringer, a campaign manager in Wyoming. She's run campaigns for people like Wyoming Governor Matt Mead and former U.S. House Representative Barbara Cuban. Geringer says getting your feet wet in politics may mean taking a few hits at first.
Someone who's a newcomer and doesn't know a lot of people might not be successful the first time, but a lot of people run several times and then are successful.
Geringer says these candidates gain support as they go along for a couple of reasons.
One, their name ID grows each time they run, but two, they're bringing in people from everywhere. And they learn what they did wrong the first time and solve those problems so that they can be successful.
Currently, only 13% of the state's legislators are women, the lowest percentage in the country. The good news is that McAllister is one of 40 women who ran in the state's legislative primaries, more than in other recent elections. But actually getting elected is tough. McAllister lost in the primary again this year, but she isn't too down.
I did pretty darn well, if you look at the races that were similar to mine, where I'm challenging an incumbent who's in the same party as me.
McAllister did gain ground. She went from around 31% of the vote in 2014 to nearly 40% this year.
I had one of the largest increases in percentage at a 7% increase. Another 7, and I could take it.
Women are only mentioned in the U.S. Constitution once, in the 19th Amendment, which grants women the right to vote. In 1923, suffragists proposed an amendment that would protect women's rights across the board. But when the vote came to Utah, it was blocked by the Mormon Church. We'll wrap up the show with that story from Jennifer Pemberton.
August 26th is Women's Equality Day in the United States. It's the anniversary of the day in 1920 that the Constitution was changed to give women the right to vote. It was a big victory for the National Women's Party, but their work didn't stop there. They wanted universal equal rights, and they wanted them in the Constitution. So leader Alice Paul immediately started drafting the Equal Rights Amendment.
The Equal Rights Amendment, this is one of the biggest things that the National Women's Party pushed for.
Eli Webster is a park ranger at the Belmont Paul Women's Equality National Monument in Washington, D.C. The whole text of the ERA is written on the wall. It takes all of 8 seconds to read.
Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. It was introduced in 1923 in Congress. It took all the way until 1971 and 72 for the House and the Senate to go, oh yeah, okay, that sounds like a good idea. So it's now 2016, not quite 100 years from when it was first introduced, and it is still not approved. It has still not passed Congress and then the ratification process.
Once it got through Congress, the Equal Rights Amendment was sailing through the state ratification process. When the vote came to Utah in the 1970s, it was just 5 states short of the 38 that it needed to become part of the Constitution.
Early on in 73, things seemed pretty positive. States were rapidly ratifying the Equal Rights Amendment. Utah seemed like a definite possibility. A couple of years later, you started getting church authorities starting to come on board specifically against the Equal Rights Amendment. My name's Mark Barnes. My grandmother and mother were both involved originally in the fight for the Equal Rights Amendment back in the 70s and 80s. Now I'm on the board of a group called Mormons for ERA, and we advocate for the enactment and adoption of the Equal Rights Amendment.
The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or the Mormon Church, wasn't the only organization, secular or religious, to oppose the ERA, but it changed the tide dramatically, and not just in Utah, but nationwide.
If it hadn't been for the Mormon Church, most people agree that the Equal Rights Amendment would be in the Constitution right now.
The Mormon Church considered the ERA a moral issue, not just a political one. Church officials were worried that the gender roles set by God would be degraded and that the ERA would contribute to general societal breakdown. They went so far as to say that its passage would affect their standards of right and wrong. Mormon bishops called on specific women in their wards to advocate against the Equal Rights Amendment. The message came from both on high, from church leaders, and also from among the ranks of everyday Mormon women. When the International Women's Year Convention came to Utah in 1977, the church mobilized more than 10,000 women to crash the event and vote against the resolution for the ERA.
Most of them had no idea what was going on. They had just been told, go and vote against everything.
By 1982, when the time was up to pass the ERA, 15 states had voted it down, including Utah. It was just 3 states short of passing.
Most Americans think we have an ERA. But we don't have an ERA. Women do not have protection in the Constitution.
I talked to Kate Kelly, a Mormon feminist and human rights attorney in Salt Lake City, about the LDS women who supported the ERA despite the church's official opposition to it, including the most famous Mormon supporter from that time period, Sonia Johnson, founder of the group Mormons for ERA.
Sonia Johnson was a housewife in Virginia and got thrown into the spotlight sort of by happenstance. She went to a congressional hearing because she was in the D.C. area and had a face-off with Orrin Hatch, that kind of catapulted her into the national and international spotlight. She became the counter voice, which said there are Mormons who want justice, who want our human rights to be respected and enshrined in the Constitution.
Johnson was excommunicated from the LDS Church in 1979 for her feminist views and her support of the Equal Rights Amendment.
As a Mormon girl, I heard of Sonia Johnson, but I was like, oh, she's one of those scary excommunicated people. And it wasn't until I got excommunicated myself for fighting for gender justice in the church that I read her book, and I was just floored at how nothing had changed.
Kelly started the group Ordain Women to fight for gender equality within the church. While Mormons for ERA are members of the church who are lobbying for political change that's bigger than the church. The Equal Rights Amendment would put women's equality up there with freedom of speech and religion. It's been reintroduced in Congress every year since ratification failed in 1982, and it never seems to go anywhere. But Mark Barnes thinks that this election year might be different.
I hope that having a woman president would actually sort of elevate women's rights and be an opening to actually get some movement on the Equal Rights Amendment.
We'll find out this November.
And that's it for this edition of The Modern West. The stories we heard are part of the series Women Run the West, a public radio collaboration exploring the role of women in Western politics. You can hear more stories at womenrunthewest.org. We'll be back with a new episode of The Modern West on the third Tuesday of next month. If you like what you hear, we'd appreciate a positive rating on iTunes or wherever you're listening. In the meantime, you can find more stories about The Modern West at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. Casey McNinch produced this podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. The theme music is by Jeff Troxell, and I'm Micah Schweitzer. The Modern West is a production of Wyoming Public Media.